Well, thank you for your patience and your courtesy and your listening, and we're going to have a question and answer period now. And as I said before, if you have a question for Dr. Craig, come over here to this microphone. And if you have a question for Dr. Carrier, come over here to this microphone. And we will try to alternate these questions back and forth, hopefully. And once again, let's confine ourselves to a question, not take a position, because we'll be here way, way too long if we have to listen to everybody's positions and testimony and the like. Okay. And for those of you who don't have a question, just sit back. Yeah, let's start here with a question for Dr. Craig.
Is this on? Okay, hi. I think we have a war over background evidence. You enter in natural theology, and then Dr. Carrier enters in cognitive science in talking about hallucinations. So in this war of background evidence, how exactly do you weigh what takes the weight in terms of what data that we should expect from if God wanted to reveal himself to us?
Well, is mine on? Hello? Okay. With respect to the existence of God, if the arguments of natural theology do establish that God exists, then the probability of the resurrection relative to our background information is going to depend crucially on the probability that this God would want to raise Jesus from the dead. Now, it seems to me that given what we know of Jesus' own radical personal claims, his claim to be the revelation of God the Father, his miracle working, his exorcisms, and so forth, the skeptic just isn't in a position to say justifiably that it is improbable that God would want to raise Jesus from the dead. And so I don't think that you can say that relative to our background knowledge, it's improbable that God would raise Jesus from the dead. Now, when then you add in all of the evidence that I've suggested, then I think that raises the probability that God raised him from the dead very high. Now, I would want to include all the cognitive science that you mentioned relative to hallucinations. You notice I did not deny that the disciples could have hallucinated. I don't know how one would show something like that. But what I argued was that hallucinations cannot explain all of the facts. They can't explain, well, the diversity of the various appearances, and that even if they had hallucinated, it wouldn't have led to belief in Jesus' resurrection. So I'm willing to go the mile with the hallucination theory and grant, okay, let's grant they had hallucinations. Will that still meet those criteria I laid out? And I think on a number of counts, the hallucination theory fails. If you want to look at this in more detail, look at my book that was mentioned with Gerrit Ludemann. He defends a hallucination theory, and I go into this in great detail in that book as to why I think it doesn't meet these six criteria.
Over here.
Is it on? Okay. First of all, I want to thank you guys. You guys gave us a free lunch. So, Dr. Carrier, I want to ask a question, and my assumption is that you assume that the Gospels are basically myth-making. If I'm wrong on that, you can address that too. But I'm curious, since you bring up the issue of Simon of Cyrene and the Lazarus issue, how do you explain the fact that Simon of Cyrene is stated by Mark to be the father of Rufus and Alexander? Because you only focus on Simon of Cyrene, but in Mark's context, he's talking about Rufus and Alexander as his, Simon's kids. How does that play into your myth idea? And then the idea of also John's Lazarus and Luke's Lazarus. Luke gives it as a parable, and John gives him as a historical person in Bethany. How do you? I mean, I don't see the correlation between those two.
Yeah, I'll take the last one first. As I was arguing, John is actually inventing the historical Lazarus using the fictional character, and in doing that is commenting on Luke's use of the parable. And one reason we can be we can conclude this, is the fact that this Lazarus character doesn't appear in any of the other Gospels. Here we have in the last Gospel of John, we've never heard of a historical Lazarus, despite the fact that Jesus supposedly rose him from the dead, despite the fact that he was supposedly beloved by Jesus, despite the fact that he was supposedly at the empty tomb, despite the fact that he supposedly saw Jesus and so on, and actually witnessed the crucifixion and all this. All of these things first get mentioned in John. We've never heard of them before. None of the other Gospels say this. So I think that in and of itself is a big red flag that we're looking at someone whom John is making up. And then when we see where he's getting the idea and how it makes sense that his creation of this Lazarus character is a commentary on Luke, we fully understand now what he's doing in creating this Lazarus character. With regard to Simon of Cyrene, now there's a lot of cases where I believe there's symbolism in the Gospels where we don't have the sufficient background evidence to know exactly what's going on. So we have to be more speculative in some cases than in others. For example, we know there are much more elaborate stories about Romulus, for instance, about his incarnation, death, and resurrection that we don't have. So there's a lot of times where the Gospel authors could be commenting on things, texts, and so forth that we no longer have. So we can't necessarily be sure of the reconstructions. We can only catch the ones that are obvious, like the Barabbas narrative, the Cleopas narrative, the Lazarus narrative. I think those are cases where we have enough information to actually confirm the case. And so we created basically a prior probability. Once you have enough of these cases, the prior probability that any other story in the Gospels is also symbolism is very high. And so I think that in and of itself warrants further license in trying to figure out what the symbolism might be. Now, Simon of Cyrene is I think, a significant case of this, where I can tell you what I think Mark was doing, but we don't have the documents to know for sure because they're lost to us. We don't have a lot of the documentation from the ancient world. So I can only give you a hypothesis that's unprovable in my view. But then, so again, is the other hypothesis that he was an actual man with sons. We can't prove that hypothesis either. We don't have any particular evidence for it, despite certain archaeological finds that actually aren't statistically determinative of whether it was the actual Simon of Cyrene that we're talking about. But my speculation is, my hypothesis would be that, first of all, Simon is from Cyrene, which is the land beyond Egypt. It's on the other side of Egypt. So he's gone from the other side of Egypt all the way over to Jerusalem. Egypt was a common symbol of death. So in a sense, he's representing the way of death. And his by being the father of two particularly famous people on the ancient world, Alexander the Great and Rufus, Musonius Rufus. Musonius Rufus was in the Roman period regarded as the second Socrates, and he had many moral teachings that were very similar to Jesus's. So in a sense, the commentary is that the way of Stoicism that Musonius Rufus represented is not the correct way, not the correct path to salvation. And the way of Alexander the Great, of seeking glory and conquest, is also not the way of salvation. And then what we have here is Simon of Cyrene, maybe the father of these things, but by picking up the cross of Jesus, he is actually representing the path to death that Jesus is going through. But of course, Jesus is going to represent salvation for those who actually accept his atoning sacrifice. Now, that's pure speculation. I agree. I mean, there's no way I can prove this or anything. It's the other cases that I presented here today and a few others that I think I can prove because the evidence is fairly clear. So all I can do is give you speculation like I did about that. And that's what I think. If it's not that, then I do think it's symbolism in some other respect that is lost to us because we don't have the documents.
Okay. Let's go back over here for a question for Dr. Okay. Craig.
Dr. Lane, Dr. Carrier, central explanation for appearances was hallucinations. Given that hallucinations in psychoanalysis are held as individual events, how would you refute the fact that obviously we've had multiple individuals have the same hallucination? And wouldn't that be like me having a dream, going up to my friends in the morning and say, "Wow, what a dream we had last night. Let's pick it up tonight."
Well, in one sense, you're right, because since hallucinations are projections of a person's own mind, they cannot be literally shared because they are intramental. However, there are group hallucinations in the sense that there can be groups of people who imagine that they are seeing the same thing at the same time, and these are documented. So you can't rule it out absolutely. But I do think that what you have in the case of the Gospels is you have such diversity that it breaks all parallels in the psychological case books. The appearances appear not just to one person, but to many individuals. not just to individuals, but to groups of people, not just under one location and one set of circumstances, but at multiple locales and under a variety of circumstances, not just to believers, but also to unbelievers as well. And this kind of diversity simply can't be accommodated by the psychological theory of hallucinations. I think it renders it quite improbable, along with all of the other arguments against hallucinations that I mentioned.
Thank you.
Over here.
Thank you, Dr. Carrier and Dr. Craig, for coming to Northwest. Dr. Carrier, with your hallucination theory, I was wondering if you can back up the hallucination theory by stating in today's science what the DSM-4 says about hallucinations and the criteria as to how we can conclude that Paul and others, based on what the DSM-4 says about grief hallucinations, that they had those hallucinations.
Well, the DSM-4 is actually a diagnostic manual for determining mental illness. I'm not actually proposing that Christians were mentally ill, so I don't think that's relevant here. What's relevant are the definitions of hallucination in cognitive science and in anthropology and sociology, for example, and the studies of religions, for example, the Shaker cults and the Santero cults and the Cargo cults, and various other examples of religious groups, even mass groups, having hallucinations. Of course, they would be convincing themselves that they were having common hallucinations, even when literally they weren't. I'm not exactly sure what you are looking for, though, in terms of definition of...
Well, what I heard you say was by today, based on today's science, we can know that they had hallucinations. And so basically the psychiatric encyclopedia, okay, to be able to tell is the DSM-4. The DSM-5 is coming out, but the DSM-4 is...
Well, I mean, you're focused on a diagnostic manual for mental illness, and that's not relevant to here. If you're looking for studies of hallucination in religious contexts, I give several examples citing it in the scholarship in The Empty Tomb, where I have a section where I'm talking about hallucination in my spiritual body chapter. I have sources cited there, a lot of them that are worth reading on this subject. I think I also revisit it in Not the Impossible Faith, if you're looking for that, if that's what you're looking for there in terms of that. Where we have, in many cases, actually through brain scans as well, confirmed that people can hallucinate through natural means, and that it's actually common. I mean, one example is the hypnagogic and hippopompic hallucinations, which have been studied extensively in science. If you look in science journals and so forth, look for hypnopompic hallucination or hypnagogic hallucination. You'll see many examples of how even normal people can hallucinate. So this is, if you're looking for a kind of definition of what hallucination is, how we understand it's physiologically produced, and the fact that these things aren't real. I mean, if you're being, you know, killed by a succubus in a hallucination, I don't think there's anyone in this room that would believe that that's actually happening. And there's a lot of cases where we have religious people seeing things in the skies, meeting people that don't exist, talking to gods and so forth, that span huge numbers of traditions. And so they can't all be true. So in fact, even if any of them are true, the probability that one we're focusing on, like Christianity, that these are the true visions and all the others are hallucinations, the probability of that is low. So you would need very strong evidence confirming that the Christian case was exceptional, and we don't have very strong evidence that the Christian case was exceptional compared to all other religions and other hallucinatory contexts.
Thank you. And just a real quick question. Can you both please define ad hoc? Because I forgot my Webster tonight, so.
It means contrived or artificial.
It means made up out of whole cloth or yeah, with it, not in basis of evidence, I suppose you'd say.
Thank you. Over here.
Since you're both a theologian and a historian, I'm going to address you as both with this question.
All right.
In all non-theological history regarding Caesar, Washington, whatever, we take documents that we allow, which we allow could be fallible, not correct in every area. And we take them, and from them, using our best discernment, we ascertain to the best of our ability what probably or what did happen. So with regard to the four Gospels, how necessary is it to treat the four Gospels as infallible and inerrant, especially when they do have several, and I'm going to use the word apparent contradictions such as Judas' death.
Jesus' death is not performed by the way. I'm not saying it contradicts, I'm just saying...
Sure.
Yeah. But it appears to, at the very least. How important is it for us to believe that these four documents are infallible? And to what extent does that belief affect our ability to historically assess them?
It plays no role at all in the argument that I presented tonight. We're treating the Gospels as ordinary historical documents, not as inspired or holy or infallible books. As Richard himself acknowledges, even writings that are filled with errors, lies, contradictions, and so forth can have historical nuggets in them that the historian can mine for valuable knowledge of the past. So, for example, take the apocryphal Gospels, these forged Gospels that came hundreds of years after the death of Jesus. Even though these are filled with fabulous legends and stories, nevertheless, there are historical nuggets in them that can be extracted and can be found when you apply to them the criteria for authenticity. So the thing about the argument that I presented tonight is that it's not based in any way on presupposing that the Gospels are inspired or infallible or anything of that sort, but that we just approach them using the ordinary canons of historical scholarship that we would use for investigating other documents of ancient history. And what emerges from this study is, as I say, remarkably, is that facts like the crucifixion, the burial of Jesus, the discovery of his empty tomb, these post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection can be well established as belonging to the historical core of what we know about this man, Jesus of Nazareth.
Okay, thanks. Over here. All right. Can you hear me? All right. Thank you guys for coming out. I know you've probably been thanked many of times. But my question for Dr. Carrier. In your first argument, you outlined the whole concept of Barabbas. And based on the uncommon name, what you said, it was an uncommon for a man to be named Barabbas during that time. Based on the uncommon name, how can you say he never existed? My mother has a very uncommon name, yet she exists. and so... And you said one means son of the Father as well as the other. As Dr. Craig said, as I study my Bible, I'm very much of a Christian. I try to keep the Bible in its proper context when reading the Word so I can see the point of view that the author originally intended. And so what if one name could probably mean son of just an earthly father? You know, son of the biological father, while Jesus Christ obviously means son of God, the heavenly Father. So just basically, what do you have to say to that?
Well, if it meant son of the biological father, that would still be a fake name. But I want to address your first question, because no one names their kid son of the father in that sense. But the point about the uncommon name, merely being an uncommon name, I completely agree with you, that would not be sufficient evidence for someone's non-existence, not at all. And I would not make that argument, and I didn't make that argument. It's the conjunction of all of the coincidences with the conjunction of the implausibilities of the historical story being told. So when we look at the entire context of the Barabbas narrative, where it exactly matches the Yom Kippur annual ceremony in a story about an annual ceremony that otherwise we have no evidence existing and probably didn't exist because it's not something the Romans would do, and that it exactly matches the story of the gospel where we have the one person being granted the sins of Israel, murder and insurrection, and then one person dying for the sins of Israel, exactly like the goats in the ceremony. And then what you see is this key word, Barabbas, son of the Father, exactly paralleling Jesus as the son of the Father. When you see the conjunction of all of these things, I think it's beyond any doubt that we're looking at symbolic fiction, the same way that other myths, the pagan myths, were written in the same way, where they would tell stories like this. We have biographies of Romulus, for example, where we have stories like this that are constructed symbolically. So that it's the conjunction of all the evidence that can come to the conclusion, not the unusual name at all.
Another question
from over here.
Yes, Dr. Craig. I would like to first ask, as a setup, was the audience of Matthew Jewish, and was its author Jewish?
You're asking me?
Yes.
Whether it seems to be that that would be a Jewish gospel emphasizing Jesus as king, for example. Yeah.
Then why in the story of the guards does it say, this is verse 15 of the last chapter of Matthew, and they, having received the money, did as they were taught, and the account was spread abroad amongst Jews until this day. Uh-huh. And why is it that if it says specifically until this day, indicating a long time for this with a nebulous beginning in the past,
yeah,
is this absolutely stated as proof that there was a empty tomb that needed to be explained, since it could have just popped up later?
Yeah.
When the Jews just wanted to, the Orthodox Jews just wanted to get rid of the yeah, Christian sect.
Well, now, if you mean that a Jew could not have referred to his fellow Jews by saying this has been spread among Jews until this day, that's not a good argument, because John's gospel is very Jewish, and yet it polemicizes all the time against the Jews. So
its target was Gentiles, I think.
Well, but I mean, it's a Jewish gospel, and so I don't see why Matthew couldn't use that expression to say this has been spread among Jews until this day. And what you have in Matthew, I think, that's so interesting is you have, as you say, the tail end of what looks to be a very long controversy. The original proclamation of the disciples in Jerusalem was probably, he is risen from the dead. Now, what did the Jewish leadership respond to that? The response was to say, the disciples stole away his body. Then the Christian response to that was, no, the guard would have prevented any such theft. To which the Jewish response then was, well, the guard fell asleep. And then the Christian response to that was, no, the Jewish leadership bribed the guard to say this. So what you see here is the tail end of a long controversy that goes back to, I think, the earliest days in Jerusalem of Jewish Christians and non-Christians interacting with each other over what happened to the body of Jesus. And the non-Matthean vocabulary that's in this narrative would just be confirmatory of that long tradition that I think suggests that we have good grounds here for thinking this is not a late tradition, but rather a very early tradition that supports the historicity of the empty tomb.
Thank you.
Go to the side.
Hi. You said that there isn't enough sufficient evidence. However, you follow by showing that there was historical evidence as well as evidence of eyewitness testimonies. You then said that you don't believe the Gospels because they're mythological, and the epistles then speak of Jesus rising from the dead. It seems as if there is sufficient evidence. You just don't believe it to be so. Ironically enough, you said that we could read your books to be informed about the topic. So what exactly is sufficient evidence to you?
You mean what hypothetically would have been sufficient evidence?
Yeah, like what do you think is sufficient evidence?
Yeah, I mean, there are probably 100 examples I could give that would all be sufficient for me. I'll just give you one example for that. If Jesus had risen from the dead and appeared to everyone in the world so that we had simultaneous documentation in China, India, Babylon, Rome, and so forth, that he actually did this, which we would have. I mean, if we had, for example, Mark says the whole world was covered in darkness, had that actually happened for 3 hours, during a new moon, for example, this would be widely documented by astronomers and historians throughout the world, and we would be able to corroborate it from independent traditions, and we could actually confirm, regardless of what we believe the cause of that darkness was, we could actually confirm historically that it had occurred, whatever its explanation was. The same thing could have happened for the resurrection of Jesus. If he'd appeared to people and explained, you know, this is who I am, I have risen from the dead, here is my message to you, and we had this independently corroborated worldwide, even especially in cultures where you wouldn't expect this to occur, that to me would convince me that something had happened, that this Jesus character had risen from the dead in some sense, whatever I then concluded the cause of that was. I would find that sufficient historical evidence, at least of the fact, regardless of the theology behind it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Craig, thanks again for your presentation. And my question is going to play off of Dr. Carrier's response over there. He keeps hitting at this point that Jesus appearing to the whole world, you know, if he really resurrected from the dead. First of all, you're a Christian. Has Jesus appeared to you?
No.
Okay. Now, how do you respond to that statement that Jesus has to appear to everyone? And secondly, what relevance does that have to do with the discussion of the historicity of the resurrection?
Well, it has no relevance, and it's really surprising to see this philosophical intrusion into what's supposed to be a historical discussion. A person could be a universalist. He could think that everyone is going to be saved, whether he believes in Jesus Christ or not, that the benefits of Christ's atoning death are applied to every person in the world. Whether you're a universalist, an inclusivist, an exclusivist, just has nothing to do with the historicity of the resurrection. That has to do with your theology. I'm of the persuasion that God does want all persons to be saved, to come to a knowledge of himself, and therefore that he orders the world in such a way that he places people at times and places in history where he knows that they will have opportunity to come to him and to believe in him and to be saved, and that there will be no one who will be lost because of the accidents of history or geography. That anybody who wants to be saved or even would want to be saved will be born at a time and place in history where he has adequate evidence and opportunity to be saved. Now, that's a theological conviction, and it's unrelated to the historicity of the empty tomb and things of that sort. So this just shouldn't play any role in the debate tonight. This is a question for theology or philosophy, not for the historicity of the Gospels.
Thank you.
Quickly, my question has two parts. First part being, would you agree that when you are writing a document or a debate, that citing multiple types of sources is really important to the authenticity of a document in and of itself? And the second question being, partly a statement, partly a question. You said in your first in multiple rebuttals throughout your debate towards Dr. Craig that there were numerous scholars that did not believe in the empty tomb and other such statements that Dr. Craig made. How come you did not state multiple, why did you not make multiple cites towards those statements and most of your citings being from your own books when the mark of a good writer or debater is to make multiple cites supporting his theory, none of which are his own?
Okay, I'll take the second question. I'll need to ask you about the first one because I didn't understand it. The second question, I cited that article by Gary Habermas in the Journal for the Study of the Historical Jesus, June 2005. He actually identifies 13 scholars who, by name, actually don't believe in the resurrection, or argue against the empty tomb. I personally have spoken to a large number of scholars who have expressed to me their agnosticism on the point, and Habermas didn't even look for agnostics or count them. So even just as a matter of statistical fact, according to Habermas's data, we're looking at least a quarter of all scholars that have specifically argued on this subject have taken the position that I have taken in the past and in this case as a possible position. But So already he's talking about 13 or 14 of them. If you were to add the agnostics in, because he's only measuring the pros and the cons, if you add the agnostics into the equation, the percentage goes up. Mathematically, necessarily, has to go above a quarter. So if you assume that there's a quarter also are agnostics, which I think is a more than reasonable assumption, we're looking at a 50-50 split. Now, Habermas's database was also based on, he didn't single out actual qualified experts in ancient documents and history. He counted everybody. So he included philosophers, for example, who didn't have any specific skills in this particular area. If you exclude them and only look at qualified experts, the percentages might change even again. And then, of course, another point I would like to make is that I didn't have time to in the debate, which is that Habermas makes the point that most of those who argue for the empty tomb do so on the basis that they believe that women's testimony wasn't accepted in the ancient world. So most of those people who are in that 75% of the ones that he counted are actually using an uninformed conclusion on that point. So I think once you eliminate that, then the percentage goes way above 50%. Now we're flipping the odds in the other direction, really, because then you might have changing a lot of minds in that case. Why I didn't cite them, I just mentioned the Habermas article as the sort of sweeping example of that. Now that's the second question. With regard to the first question. I didn't understand it. Could you maybe re-explain?
Basically, it
or was...
Or was
that just a prelude to the second question?
It was a prelude, like a segue into the second question.
Yeah, yeah. Interpreting your first question in light of your second question, what you're talking about is naming actual scholars who advocate a position currently right now.
Mm-hmm.
In that respect, I think one has to take into account, do you trust the biases in that particular area, and does the scholar have the relevant experience, and has he looked at the relevant evidence, and is he basing his conclusion on the correct arguments? And that's, I've just explained that to you as to, with regard to the Habermas example of his database of these scholars on this point, where you have to approach that issue critically. So I don't know if that answered your question, but...
In part, yes.
Okay, I hope so. All right.
You used as two of your five facts or pieces of evidence supporting your case, Joseph of Arimathea and the testimony of women.
Yes.
You said that their historical unlikeliness makes your case more, or gives credit to your case. I would argue that their unlikeliness actually serves better to support Marx's message, the Christian message, that they're more likely put in there to show Christians reading the Gospels and people hearing the epistles and everything, that Christians should be inclusive, that, you know, not all Jews, like Joseph of Arimathea, not all Jews are Christ killers, and not all women are crazy, and that. Oh, so how do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, I think you're reading. I think you're reading 21st century Western political correctness into the Gospels, trying to show that they're so inclusivistic and everything. And I think that's utterly foreign to their concerns. With respect to Joseph of Arimathea, remember his existence is multiply and independently attested, as well as being highly unusual. In the sense that the Christians would hardly invent somebody who's a Sanhedrist, all of whom, Mark says, condemn Jesus, who then does what's right by Jesus in giving him a burial in the tomb. So given this, it's a cumulative case. It's not based on any single fact. It's the cumulative force of all of these, I think, that suggests to the vast majority of scholars that the burial narrative is historical. And with respect to the women witnesses, again, it's incontrovertible that the testimony of women was not as highly prized in first century Judaism as the testimony of women of men. And so a late legendary account would in all probability make men discover the empty tomb, because any conceivable role played by women would be more aptly played by men and give more credible testimony. I think the reason that women are the discoverers of the empty tomb is very much like those Josephine examples. That was the only witnesses there were. These were the ones they had. These were the ones who really did it. And therefore, the Gospels faithfully record it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Dr. Carrier, the naturalistic explanation you gave for the postmortem appearance of Christ to people is that of mass hallucinations. Some quotes by you tonight are, the Christians were regularly hallucinating. Christians were prone to hallucinating. They did it all the time. And other cults facing failure with no other way to move on also relied on this. You failed to address the fact that Paul, who is not a member of this alleged cult, had one of these, quote, hallucinations while he was actually on his way to arrest some Christians. And you didn't address the fact that his life was radically different afterwards, how he was hunted, nearly arrested, had to escape imminent death in multiple situations. And he ultimately did die in a cell proclaiming the word of Christ. As a man who probably would consider himself logical, how could you say that his life after this, quote, hallucination could be possibly attributed to nothing other than the transformative powers of God and merely to a hallucination?
Well, I think Paul genuinely believed. Paul genuinely believed what he saw. I don't think Paul thought it was a hallucination, obviously. When he hallucinated Jesus communicating to him the gospel, he actually believed this was really the case. So obviously it would transform his life in all the ways that you described, because he actually thought that had actually happened. He believed it. The question is, why would Paul have that hallucination? I advance particular theories in the empty tomb as to why that might be, but I think the more important point is that why only Paul, of all the persecutors of the church? Why none of the leading persecutors of the church? Why no other persecutors of the church? Why was it just one guy? And I think the reason being is that precisely because it's unusual, it would be uncommon, let's say, statistically a low frequency of particular persecutors coming to realize, for example, that they actually agree with the Christian message, their moral message, for example, and start to feel guilt, for example, about persecuting the church. You can come up with explanations like that as a particular psychological reasons why. You can come up with several. We don't know enough information about what Paul actually was thinking at the time to actually know. So the question really is, statistically, what's going to be the case? Statistically, if there's going to be any psychological explanation for Paul to suddenly have this revelation to himself and convince himself that the Christians are right and that Jesus is actually was risen from the dead and so forth. Whatever explanation that might be, it's going to be uncommon. And the fact that Paul is extremely uncommon, in fact, unique, there's only one persecutor of the church that this happened to, I think that confirms the prediction of my theory that what we're looking at are unique psychological conditions that actually inspired Paul to have this hallucination. And the fact that Paul is alone confirms that prediction. Whereas if you take the theory, and against Craig, what he was saying earlier, that I do think the issue of whether Jesus would appear to all people is historically relevant. It's not a theological point. I'm not talking philosophy here. I'm talking about what predictions do his theory make that are different from predictions that my theory make. Now, if his theory predicts that Jesus is just going to appear in exactly the same place and way and manner that natural theories would also predict, then there isn't any way to tell the difference between natural explanations of the facts and his explanation of the facts, and consequently, we can't decide between them and we can't claim his theory is known. His theory has to make predictions that are different from the predictions made by the naturalistic theories, and those predictions have to come true, whereas the naturalistic predictions have to come false. And that doesn't come to the fore here. And we have a situation with Paul where I think is a classic example of that. The fact that Jesus only appeared to one outsider confirms the naturalistic explanation because that's exactly what naturalism predicts. Whereas the fact that Jesus didn't appear, if Jesus could have appeared, let's put it that way, Jesus could have appeared to everyone on earth, and as I mentioned earlier, had he done so, I would probably be convinced by the evidence of it, because there would be a tremendous amount of evidence confirming this thing that would have no other naturalistic explanation, in my view, or at least no easy naturalistic explanation. So that's what I'm talking about when I say Jesus could appear to everyone. I'm not saying Jesus had to appear to everyone, or they necessarily would have. I'm saying that that's the kind of thing that you would expect for that particular kind of theory. Jesus wants people to have this message. Obviously, if I wanted people to have a particular message that's going to transform their life, make their lives better, and I had the means to appear to everyone and give them a short discussion of this and give them some sort of evidence that this is really the thing they should follow, I would do so. But obviously, I can't be more compassionate or more intelligent than God. So if God also had the same desire and that means, he would have done so. So I say this is a prediction of Craig's theory that is actually falsified by the historical evidence. And that's the position I take with regard to your question and its relation to other topics like that.
Thanks.
Okay. We have time to take one more from each side, I think, and that'll probably be it.
Okay, so my question actually kind of goes off of what Dr. Carrier just said. And he mentioned earlier today and in a previous debate between the two of you that if the God of the universe truly wanted everyone to be saved, that Jesus Christ should have appeared to everyone and not just to the people who did. So going off of that argument, and I feel like you didn't adequately answer it, but could you just give us some more references or some more explanations as to either why Jesus Christ only appeared to the few, why he didn't appear to everyone, or both?
Yes, I'm glad to address that topic. I don't think that we can know with any probability at all that if Jesus was genuinely divine and risen from the dead, that he would appear to everybody on earth. Why think that? The only reason is if you think that somehow appearing on earth would win the salvation of more people than not doing so. But suppose you're a universalist. Suppose you believe that everybody is saved, regardless of their response to Christ, then there's no probability that if Christ is risen from the dead, he would appear to everybody on earth. Suppose instead you take my view, which is what I call a middle knowledge perspective. On a middle knowledge perspective, God knows exactly what sort of evidence would elicit the affirmative response of people in various circumstances. And he can providentially order the world so that anyone who would freely embrace God and his salvation is born at a time and place in history where he does hear the message of the gospel and is given sufficient evidence. On that kind of middle knowledge perspective, there's no probability at all that Jesus Christ would appear to everybody in the world. Maybe what Richard doesn't appreciate is that God doesn't simply want people to believe that he exists or that Jesus is risen from the dead. That's really a sort of matter of relative indifference, according to the Bible, to God. What God really wants is for people to enter into a love relationship with him, to come to know him and his love. And if God, as Richard has said in his writings, wrote in the moon, Jesus lives, or he arranged the stars so that they spelled out Jesus lives in the heavens, well, more people might come to believe that Jesus is risen from the dead, but there's no guarantee at all that that would lead more people into a saving love relationship with him. Indeed, I could well imagine that in such a world, after a while, people would begin to chafe under such brazen advertisements of the Creator and resent his effrontery for such brazen advertisements of his existence. I think that God, endowed with middle knowledge and with the witness of his Holy Spirit, knows exactly the circumstances and the people to create in the world and at the various times and places in history in such a way as to bring the optimal number of people freely to himself. And so given that theological conviction, there's no probability at all that Jesus would appear to everybody on earth. The purpose of the appearances in the Gospels, to repeat, was not to convince people in general Jesus was risen from the dead. It was to commission the disciples to the task of world evangelization. And that task has been carried out remarkably well. Christianity is the hugest, most successful movement in the history of mankind, which is continuing to change lives and to spread with rapidity all across the face of the globe. And I think that we're simply not in a position to gainsay God's wisdom in the way in which he has chosen to have this message brought to mankind. So I guess I just don't see any probability that if God exists and he raised Jesus from the dead, that Jesus would appear to every single person in the world.
Thank you.
Last question over here.
All right, I'm happy to be the last question. Thanks. This is for Dr. Carrier and Dr. Craig. I think you'll both enjoy this question a little bit. This is assuming Christianity could be a myth, and also that myth could become history. How many people in here have a TV? Okay, I'm in college and stuff. I took this class called Theories of Mass Communication. We learned about this thing called the social construct theory. It talks about how people shape their realities off of symbology found in, like media propaganda. This can be like music over images. It's called transfer method, card stacking, taking certain information and hiding the rest. There are tons of ways to do this. So our lessons are learned by fiction, Shakespeare, our stories of love, like what that is. They can lead to jealousy, envy, temporary inspiration. They're usually like dead end endings. And I'm going to ask a question, I promise.
I hope so.
Well, I got to... Okay, so with these many myths shaping our history, we pursue stories in a pseudo-schizophrenic kind of way, creating our realities. This gets more frightening in an age where media consumes our society, like especially American society. And of course, awareness of all these myths, they can allow us to be more empirical. They can allow us, to be in truth, be free. And assuming Jesus is a myth, this could be a myth that frees us from other myths, brings us into truth, intervention in literal history. So the question is... The last book before Revelations is Jude. It warns that people will stop believing in Christ. If that happens, will society be overconsumed in media in a pyramid power type fashion, top down?
Well, of course, that involves futuristic speculation well beyond the topic of the debate today.
Postmoderns.
Yeah, so I won't give it a really elaborate response. I mean, my answer basically is no, I don't think that's the case.
Okay.
Good one. I take that back. We're going to take another question or two more questions from people that came all the way from Omaha. So step up to the mic. Is it on this? Oh, okay.
My question is, Dr. Craig, it's gone back and forth a couple times. One of your primary arguments is multiple independent attestation. I'm assuming that the cumulative weight adds to the argument. I believe Dr. Carrier said it's not multiple, it's not independent, it's all a bunch of people feeding off of the same story. Can you elaborate a little bit on what multiple independent is?
One of the most important criteria of authenticity that historical Jesus scholars use would be to have independent descriptions of the same event that are early. Because it's highly improbable that two people would independently make up the same story. So if you can find a saying or an event in the life of Jesus that is attested in independent and early sources, that increases the probability that it goes back to the historical Jesus. And as I say, usually scholars are delighted to find two such independent and early sources. But in the case of the burial and the empty tomb, we have five or six such very, very early sources which are independent. These include things like the pre-Mark and Passion story and the pre-Pauline tradition that is quoted in 1 Corinthians 15, which goes back to it just in a few years of the events. So one of the weaknesses, I think, of Richard's analysis historically of Jesus and his story is that Richard isn't sufficiently working with the sources behind the Gospels. He just treats Matthew and Luke as dependent upon Mark. He thinks that Mark is the only source of the other Gospels. I gather he thinks that John is not independent of the Synoptics, whereas I think he needs to come to grips with the fact that these authors are working with earlier sources that are not all dependent upon Mark. And so we have independent and early attestation to these events, and that increases the probability that we're getting here, as I say, back to historical pay dirt.
Is that essentially how you're ruling out collusion?
Ruling out what?
Collusion on their
right,
part?
Right, yeah, collusion would be, if for example, Matthew and Luke's only source for the Passion story were Mark, then in that sense, the witness of Matthew and Luke wouldn't count as anything additional to Mark. But what scholars have been able to show is that there are special sources behind Matthew and Luke, usually called M and L for obvious reasons, which contain information that they didn't get from Mark and can't be explained as just editorial additions to Mark made by Matthew and Luke. And as I say, John is generally regarded as independent of the Synoptics. So you've got good grounds here for thinking that this isn't, as you put it, the result of collusion or just literary copying or literary dependence.
Is this our last question?
Okay. Thank you very much for taking the question, and thank you both to Dr. Craig and Dr. Carrier. Dr. Carrier, in your comments about the Gospels being myth and the amount of literary devices that are included in those, it seems that you give the four gospel writers, who are from very diverse occupations, one of whom is a fisherman, and an incredible and, in my mind, implausible amount of knowledge of very intricate literary devices that only very scholarly and learned individuals would have had access to. given the fact that in Acts, even the Jewish leaders take note that John is an unschooled man. Would you respond to the question of how four diverse writers would have this incredible amount of intricate literary knowledge to get the point across to create a myth?
Well, first of all, Acts doesn't say that John wrote our John. In fact, we don't know that any of the authors of the epistles, or I mean, the Gospels, were fishermen. We don't have any information. None of the Gospel authors claim to have been fishermen. The fact of the matter is, as Dennis MacDonald shows in his on the Homeric epics and the Gospel of Mark, in the first chapter,